What I would encourage you to do now, because I've given you what I think is the framework in which you need to read the play, is to just head onward reading it. From this point, you can go right to the end. There is a kind of tragic inevitability to the events now. And you can watch the thing play itself out, although it happens brilliantly. You're watching a master of evil at work, and the poetry is magnificent. It's one of Shakespeare's most perfect plays, and by that I mean everything in it is balanced. It's considered one of his most perfectly constructed plays. He was at the absolute peak of his form. No wasted details, structurally just brilliant. There are some people who have counted the numbers of exits and entrances, and they sort of, maybe accidental, who knows. Dealing with this man, nothing seems accidental. All seems intentional. Eventually we do have that tape. And on Friday, even if I don't get all the way through the play, we'll watch the opera. It's a film by Franco Zeffirelli. And on Friday I'll talk about some of the differences between the drama and the opera. They're two very different works. Very different works. Even though they're usually spoken of in the same breath. Verdi's Otello is a great masterpiece, as is Shakespeare's play, but they are two different works from two different artists, two different centuries. Let me open the floor up for questions. I've talked too much already today. Father Fullerton, yes.
I had a question about the line of Rodrigo. Immediately at the beginning, after Iago's discourse there, I followed him to serve my term upon him. And then after that terrible discourse that he puts forth, Rodrigo says, "What a full fortune does the thick lips owe if he can carry it thus?"
Yeah.
I'm not understanding the response of it.
Oh, okay. Notice what's interesting.
Iago gives the long disquisition on serving a master. Okay, the two kinds of servitude. Those who are foolish enough to follow out of goodwill and do the master's bidding and never get rewarded for it. The good servant that he claims is a fool. And then on the other hand, the clever servant who is the one who seems to serve but is actually just out for the self. Through that whole long speech, Rodrigo's only thinking about himself. Okay? So Rodrigo is still thinking about the fact that Othello has stolen away this woman that he hoped to marry. So that he has not heard anything that Iago has said. Okay? Yeah. And then beyond that, he's basically saying, boy, what a lucky guy that Othello is if he can get away with this. But a couple of interesting things. What a full fortune. And it's a conversation we had earlier this week, some of us, about the difference between providence and fortune. Providence is God's design, that which God designs. There was also the concept of fortune, and that was events just happen accidentally. Well, those of us who believers know there's no such thing as fortune. God designs everything. Everything is God's design. But the world talks about fortune as if events just happen haphazardly. And that's Rodrigo's view here. Boy, is he a lucky guy. But notice the insult. And the insult has to do again with Othello's blackness. The thick lips. What a full fortune does the thick lips owe if he can carry it thus, if he can get away with this one. If that black man can steal away the daughter of a senator here in Venice, boy, he's the luckiest guy on earth. That's a paraphrase. Yeah. But I would say it's not in response to the speech at all. Self-centered. Totally self-centered. Yeah. 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 You know what's surprising through all of this? Notice there is, Iago is self-centered. Rodrigo is self-centered. Brabantio, in an interesting way, makes a just claim, but what Iago's able to do is stir up his passions. And Brabantio, the father, is out of control and angry for most of the act. And the sense is, what's happened to me? What's been done to me? All these characters are very much self-centered. It's interesting that there is a love between Othello and Desdemona. Their self-centeredness is the way in which they've acted upon it to get what they want. But there's no denying it is a real love, and they are both outside. In that sense, it is a higher love than most anything else we see in the first act of the play. It's a real love. The Duke is out for himself. He wants to defend his city. He doesn't care what's happened to Brabantio. He doesn't, you know. The whole first act is just filled with selfishness, except for that great love. That's curious. That's curious. Yeah. Other questions at all? Either the play or just Shakespeare in general, or teaching Shakespeare. Sure, go ahead.
The other question about some of our youngsters here who were thinking of the possibility of putting on Othello as a high school play.
Yeah.
And what your advice and views might be on possibilities there.
Yeah. Two things. First, Shakespeare would be absolutely stunned to know we're sitting around talking about the play, reading it from a book. Okay? He was a man of the theater. He wrote this to be performed. He did not bother to collect and publish his own plays. We're just very lucky that two of his colleagues who were actors after his death decided, we better gather these up and put them in one big book. So that, again, Shakespeare was medieval enough not to go out of his way to see to it that his name would be on the collected works of William Shakespeare, famous. He wasn't interested in that. And in a way, that's the medieval part of him again. But thanks to Hemings and Condell, who were two men who acted with him, they were collected, they were published, we have the plays. Which means he would want it to be performed. So in that sense, I would encourage people. Any chance you get, perform it. That's how it's meant to be seen. The only, I don't want to throw cold water on it. I would just say this is really difficult. The major tragedies are very, very difficult. It might be safer to do some scenes rather than attempting to do the whole thing. It would be very good to work on some of the scenes. If you want to do a whole play, I would go to some of the earlier comedies. I think they'd just be easier for young people to perform. Or I might go to Romeo and Juliet, which is a young person's play. Easier to perform than this. It's just a matter of, you know, why knock yourself out? Some years ago, I had a friend who was directing Othello. So I edited the script for him, and I wasn't there to actually see the production. I heard it was very good. He had very fine actors. It was a college performance, but he told me afterwards they all nearly killed themselves. It's difficult to do. It's hard work. And then you rehearse this, and then you run it for a few weeks, and you're doing this every night. It'll take the wind out of you. It's not an easy... Imagine every night you go to the theater, and you have to live through this. That's not an easy thing to do. It's why I said earlier, Olivier went into training. He played it for a year and a half. For a year and a half, he went to the theater 8 times a week and lived through this. I mean, that's like a great athlete who has to run a marathon every day, sometimes twice a day. Matinee marathon and an evening marathon, you know. And that's hard work, so. That's just practical. But I would certainly encourage young people to do it. Yeah, do scenes from it, do parts of it. Well worth the doing. You can learn a lot doing it.
I don't know if we're going to talk about or anything, but it seems like many Shakespeare plays, they're just reading lines and they don't really have an appreciation or understanding of it.
It's one of the problems. It's one of the problems with any drama, and it's particularly the case with Shakespeare is that it's particularly the problem with American actors who you can go to see some Americans attempting to perform Shakespeare and they have no idea what they're saying. They've learned the words and they're repeating the words, but there's not much thought behind it. And the words are not easy. And it's hard work to go through it and have clear in your own mind exactly what's intended. That's tough. It's hard work. But again, it's a complaint I have of many modern performing musicians. They simply play the notes on the page, and there's no heart, there's just no oomph behind it. And it's very much the same case here. You know, you can play a Bach Prelude and Fugue and play all the notes right, and it can be as boring as 4-day old Coca-Cola. Just, there's no fizz, there's not, it's blah, you know, who needs it? Or you can have a musician, and not just a professional, somebody who sits down, who's thought through it and worked at it and has the energy and the life and gives a vision to it, you know.
The majors really do that. They have the
understanding
of it, and they give that to
you. Well, I'll tell you, it should be part of the director's job. And then what you get is there are good directors and bad directors. Or there are directors who understand a play or don't understand a play. Or you can even get, I'll tell you, I was out in Oregon earlier this summer at the Ashland Shakespeare Festival. If any of you have been in that area, it's quite a good theater. They have 3 different theaters running simultaneously. They have over 600,000 people that come every year to see theater done there. I mean, that's an astonishing, huge operation. They did Shakespeare's Coriolanus in the big outdoor theater. The director updated it, which can often be just a disaster. The director had a clever idea, okay? So he sort of, instead of Rome, he set it in a contemporary vision, and they had gun belts and Uzis and, you know, we're going up and, usually I don't like that sort of thing, but it worked pretty well here. It was working, there were some good ideas. And I was and the actor who was playing Coriolanus was brilliant. Interestingly enough, a black man. And I thought, this isn't going to work. He was great. He was great. He had total control of the language, and he was 6'5". And boy, you better believe he took that stage when he walked out there and whoa. But the director cut the last 20 lines of the play. We got to the end of the play and he cut the ending. And I was sitting there going, and what he had done was, well, the principal, the title character is dead now, so we don't need the last few, and we'll just wrap it up here. It would be like playing sitting through a Beethoven symphony, and you get to the end, and then the orchestra doesn't play the final chord. Just, so you can even have a good director with a good idea who, and it's working, and all of a sudden he makes a decision that, but I'm sure if he were to sit down, he'd argue with me that he did the right thing. Oh, I've done a number of them, yeah. I've done a number of them. I've been lucky enough to work on maybe, a quarter of the plays, yeah. It's very frustrating because I can stand up here and talk and say what I want, and then you get into the practical realm of the theater and you've cast real people who have talents and sometimes not so much talent, and you work with them and you tell them what you want or wonderful things can happen, you know, that you work with them, you get them to do a part a certain way, they understand the line, opening night they go out and decide, I have a better idea, and do it their own way, and it's like, what? No, people will see this, think I did that. Or it can be something as simple as getting out there and not remembering what you're supposed to say. To be or, This can happen, and sometimes it all leaves your mind. I had a wonderful Shakespeare professor at the University of Minnesota. He was a wonderful man. I owe a great deal to him because he opened up the plays for me. He was very helpful in teaching me how to read intelligently. But he was a wonderful man. He'd come into class and he'd just pace the room back and forth as fast as he could go and smoke cigarettes one after another. Light up another one, and sometimes he had 2 going at one time. He'd go to one side of the room and then walk to the other side and take another one. And his mind was just going a mile a minute, and you could barely keep up with him and taking notes as fast as you could. But one day it actually happened, and he was drawing a comparison. And he was talking about one of the tragedies, and he said, well, of course, this is what we get in the later tragedies, in the major tragedies, but of course, in a tragedy written early in Shakespeare's career, for example, Romeo and, and he's pacing back, and everybody in the class is going, and, except we couldn't stop him. And it was like, it was like something had happened to the man's brain. It was just caught. And for about 30 times, he said, Romeo and, and then there was this explosion of Juliet, and he went on. Those of you who are young won't understand that, but let me tell you, as you get older, the brain turns into Swiss cheese, and you just start forgetting things. And it can happen to actors on a stage. You don't know. The theater is a wonderful place. I do love it, but it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating. You try your best, but it's absolutely true. You rehearse, you work, you train the actors. You don't know till opening night what you've got. You have no idea how it's going to go or what it's going to be. It's a gamble. And many times it's just awful. and that's in spite of the fact that you tried your best. It can still be just awful. I think of some productions I've done that have been just horrible. But I assure you that was not my intention in starting out. It just somehow ends up that way. Yes.
Professor, could you comment on whether or not music ever played a part in the plays?
Oh, always. Always, always. In fact, we know that because there were musicians who were members of Shakespeare's company, and therefore they would be used. And specifically, the plays almost always include songs. And the songs would be set. We have some of the settings, actually. We have some of the actual settings, not all of them. The great moment in Othello comes in Act 4. Might as well turn ahead. We can take a look at it. Act 4, Scene 3, line about 40. And what Shakespeare will often do is save the music until an important dramatic moment. When he wants to really push a dramatic effect, he will give us a song. That's the case here. We're looking at this out of context, but you'll notice Desdemona, this is an intimate scene with Emilia, who is Iago's wife. Desdemona's preparing for bed. Emilia's her maid. They're getting her ready. She is filled with sorrow, and she begins singing this song, and it's called the Willow Song. And we don't have the original music, but it obviously would have been set to music. There may even have been music that began in the background that would have accompanied her. We don't know for certain. The poor soul sat singing by a sycamore tree. Sing all a green willow. Her hand on her bosom, her head on her knee. Sing willow, willow, willow. The fresh streams ran by her and murmured her moan. Sing willow, willow, willow. Her salt tears fell from her and softened the stones. Sing willow, willow, willow. Lay by thee, she interrupts the song then. Willow, willow. Prithee, hie thee, he'll come anon. Sing all a green willow must be my garland. Let nobody blame him, his scorn I approve. The song keeps being interrupted, but it's a gorgeous moment of Desdemona. It's late at night. We know what's coming. She knows what's coming. And she begins singing. So, yeah. Music throughout all the plays. Some have more than others. Obviously, there's some places in Act 2 where there would have been trumpets. But he saves the music pretty much for that one moment here in this play. Many of the comedies are filled with music. His last play, The Tempest, has one song after another. Song after song after song after song. Just filled with songs. So much of it depended on the appropriateness to the play and dramatic context, how he wanted to use it. There are some plays that end with a song. Twelfth Night. Twelfth Night. Everything's finished, and then suddenly the clown comes out and ends the play by singing a little song that seems not to connect to the play. It does. But seemingly it's like, well, there, now that was our play, now let's have a song. And out comes the clown and begins singing, when that I was and a little tiny boy, with hey ho the wind and the rain, a foolish thing was but a toy, for the rain it raineth every day. That's one of those we have the music for. So he obviously loved music. In fact, well, this is from Merchant of Venice. One character talking about another and saying, you know, there are people who don't like music. And the response comes, the man that hath no music in himself and is not moved with concord of sweet sounds is fit for treason, stratagems, and spoils. If you find somebody who really doesn't like music, look out. Look out, because it suggests a lack of inner concord. We might say it's a lack of harmony, it's a lack of thymos. It's a lack of that human warmth that connects us with other people. So look out. He loved music, he speaks highly of music. Yeah.
Did you go over these authors and people talk about their education, their background, and how they worked for the past?
Yes.
Yes. What was Shakespeare's?
Shakespeare had an eighth grade education from a small rural town in England. It was a better education than a Harvard PhD today. Okay? And I'm not joking. That I say that to my students, they think I'm joking. I am not joking. I am not joking. An eighth grade education, let's see, he probably would have been 1576 he probably left school. Somewhere around 1576, 78. He went to the local grammar school. He makes fun of one of his teachers in an early comedy called Love's Labor's Lost. He makes fun of his old Latin teacher. But what we know is he learned some Greek, he learned some Latin, he learned history, he would have studied some classical literature, he probably would have had a good background in mythology. We know he read Ovid. He loves Ovid. He uses Ovid over and over and over again. Would have been a very fine education. Now, he was scorned by some of the really educated writers of the day, especially his friend Ben Jonson. They were friendly rivals, constantly sort of at each other again, in a way that only men who respect each other can. Witness table talk here at the seminary. There's that wonderful sense of, you know, sharing something so deeply that you're constantly making fun of each other. Jonson was constantly making fun of Shakespeare. And annoyed with Shakespeare. Some quick examples. We know that the one account we have of Shakespeare actually writing comes from a man who had apparently been to the playhouse and seen the playwright with his pen and paper working on a play. And Jonson was notorious for taking forever on his plays. And this fellow says, by contrast, Master Shakespeare never blotted out a line. He never made corrections. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing them, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. We have other examples of that. We can look at the manuscripts of Mozart. As he said, it was all in his head, he just put it down. There aren't corrections, as opposed to poor Beethoven, the manuscripts are a mess. He was constantly changing and scratching out. Well, Ben Jonson did the same thing. Writing and rewriting and rewriting and correcting and changing. Well, Jonson was very annoyed. The man says to him, Master Shakespeare never blotted out a line. And Jonson's response was, would he had blotted 1,000? It's messy. This stuff is messy. He didn't take enough time. Another thing he says at one point is that Shakespeare had small Latin and less Greek. He knew Greek and Latin, but he didn't know a lot of Latin, and he only knew a little bit of Greek. Well, eighth grade, you know, my Latin's lousy in Greek. It's Greek to me, to quote Shakespeare. You know, point being, he had a very good, very solid education. That then apparently allowed him to go on, continue reading and learn more. But let me put it this way: the best example that we can give that Shakespeare had a real education is that it created in him a love of learning, and he continued learning. And he obviously loved language. He devoted his life to it. That's something. One more Ben Jonson story. The one that Shakespeare had a degree of pride in him. He was a commoner and knew it. And the one thing he wanted in his career was to raise the family name to the status of the gentry. He wanted to be a gentleman. He wanted to be a gentleman. And fortunately lived in a time when if you got enough money, you could buy a title. You could buy a title and you could buy a coat of arms for the family. And part of this may come out of some disgrace he felt because his father had a prominent position in Stratford and then fell from favor. And we don't know the exact cause, but we think it's probably because he refused to go to the new mass. When that new religious service was instituted in Stratford, everybody in England was required to go. Many Catholics dug in their heels and said, no, I'm not going to that new thing. And we know this because then they had to pay a fine. And their names are listed on those who paid fines rather than attend the new service. And John Shakespeare's name appears over and over again. In any case, he probably then also lost his position as bailiff of the town. Something like sheriff, you know. And he was removed. So Shakespeare was always trying to put the family name back in the good graces of the public. So he saves money, and finally, in about the time he's writing Othello, he buys a coat of arms for the family, for the Shakespeare family. And he becomes William Shakespeare Gentleman. And he chooses the family motto, which says in Latin, not without right. We have a right. We may have been commoners, but we have a right to be now gentlemen. The family has earned this right. The very next play that Jonson writes has a character who buys a coat of arms for his family and pretends to be a gentleman. And the motto of this character in the play, the family's motto, is not without mustard. Which is obvious, it's a deliberate slap at Shakespeare and his pretensions. And of course, Jonson was Oxford educated, so he looked down on this man with the eighth grade education, you know. Friendly rivals, and yet at the time, after Shakespeare's death, Jonson writes the greatest elegy in the English language, called To My Beloved Master. Incredible admission that Jonson's making. To my beloved master, William Shakespeare, and what he hath left us. In which, for the first time, occurs the recognition that this guy was an immortal genius, and the genius will last forever. It's in that poem that comes the great line, he was not of an age, but for all time. And Jonson was the first one to admit it. It must have just galled him. It must have just galled him to do it. But he was writing an elegy for a friend. So, an eighth grade education. I wish I had had such an eighth grade. I would trade in my PhD for that eighth grade education. And I mean that. That's not a joke. I mean that. Yeah. Yes?
I had a question concerning the love of Desdemona and Othello compared right. with the Winter's Tale. The two figures there.
Yeah. Leontes and Hermione, yes.
Well, I'm thinking more of Perdita and...
Oh, Perdita and Florizel.
They do something similar. They fall in love.
Yes.
The shepherdess and the prince.
That's right.
And they have to take off. And what's the difference between the two loves? Because there seems to be more...
Good. Good. Yeah. In fact, Shakespeare clearly has Othello in mind as he's writing The Winter's Tale. There are many similarities between the plots. You have the husband who falsely accuses his wife of being unfaithful. In The Winter's Tale, there's no Iago figure. Leontes just goes nuts on his own and makes a false accusation. But the difference is this. Othello, even though we're dealing with a poetic drama, is set in a real Venice. Okay? We have the sense of reality, and it keeps being emphasized over and over again that any poetic drama is transcending reality, but this play is still I would say, grounded in something very real. By the time we hit Perdita and Florizel, we're in a pastoral fairy tale landscape where the same rules don't apply, and you can get away with things in a fairy tale that you can't get away with in real life. So that when the young prince decides to disobey his own father, okay, and marry this shepherdess, we go along with it because, number one, we know she's not a shepherdess. She's indeed the daughter of a king. Number two, we know it's all going to turn out all right because everything in that fairy tale world has got to move towards a happy ending. It's the difference between comedy and tragedy. And finally, because they're young people, you know, it's the young prince and the young princess, and it's the sort of grumbly father. What we have here is very different. Othello is a mature man, a soldier who's been around for a while. Desdemona is not a princess. She's the daughter of a senator. She has more reality there, okay? And we're in a real setting. From the beginning, this is not a fairy tale story. This is not a fairy tale world. And somehow our ability to respond to any work of literature depends on the context in which we find it. And Shakespeare would use that. I mean, there are times when he creates, he'll create one world and then shatter it. But that's not the case here. We remain rooted very much in reality. And the play becomes more and more real as it goes along. So that, I guess my answer would be context. This play is a tragedy and we know it. We feel it from the start. The Winter's Tale, and particularly by the time we reach that point, is a fairy tale comic romance. And we're not too worried because we know it's going to turn out all right. And he keeps assuring us of that. The play reassures us of that. We feel the ominous overtones right from the start here. Right from the start. Yeah. The heaviness is there. This is not going to come to a good ending. We just know it. We feel it. Yeah.
Similarity between Cordelia and King Lear and Desdemona.
Oh, yeah.
With both the knowledge of double duty and seem to be crushed by it.
Exactly.
Would you say about that?
Yes. It's clearly, again, on his mind because Lear was probably written just after this. Cordelia, again, in one sense, refuses. She acknowledges a double duty, but she refuses an order from her father. However, she doesn't go behind his back. He tells, for those of you that don't know Lear, it's a fairly simple thing at the beginning. He's going to divide up his kingdom. He has his three daughters. And he says, look, tell me how much each of you loves me. And the one who says that you love me the most gets the biggest chunk of the kingdom. And the other two daughters play the game and just, you know, fall all over themselves. Ooh, I love you, I love you, I love you. Ooh, I love you so much. But of course, they're Iago-like and then it's phony. They're not telling the truth. And then he comes to Cordelia, whom he says, essentially my favorite. You're the one I love the most. So you really know. Now really tell me how much you love me. Words have been ruined by that point. She can't say, well, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Her two sisters have already said that. He says, what have you to say to earn a third more opulent than your sisters? Speak. And she says, nothing. He says, nothing? Nothing will come of nothing. Speak yet again. Nothing, my lord. And she says, look, I love you, I obey you, I honor you, as is my duty. But that's it. I'm about to be married. My husband will carry half my love. You're exactly right. It's the same situation. Now, she's not going around her father. She's not abusing his authority. She's just refusing to play a game, a phony game that he's set up. So in one sense, I would say Cordelia remains loyal to her father. It's seeming disloyalty in the same way that Kent is seemingly disloyal in suddenly saying, Lear, what are you doing? You're a foolish old man. See better, Lear. She doesn't love you any the less. You've set up an impossible contest. And he banishes Kent and he banishes the people who really love him. Lear is an amazing play. Yeah. So I'd say it seems similar. We actually have a very different situation. Probably. Yeah. Same situation, yes. And in fact, you know, the late in his career, Shakespeare writes part of a play called Henry VIII. It's only part of a play. It was a collaboration with Fletcher. Some of the scenes are Shakespeare. Some of it was written by Fletcher, and you can tell who did what. And he's very much aware of that. I think he's same thing in The Winter's Tale, where the king casts off the queen, and she's a loyal and good and true queen, and he casts her away. Yes, I'm sure. I think he was aware of it, and he was aware of what those decisions had done to his country. I mean, England was in an impossible religious situation, religious turmoil. Blood flowing across the land because of the decisions that had been made. And it was about to get worse. I mean, 20 years after his death, 25 years after his death, it's going to erupt in civil war. Just an impossible situation. He was fully aware of it. Yeah. Yeah. It's sad. It's sad.
In reference to Iago, I mean, you get the strange feeling he wasn't happily married.
Oh boy. Oh. Well, if it's a strange feeling, wait till you read on and see how he treats his wife. Oh man. Yeah.
But I have a particular line in mind.
Sure.
Act 1, Scene 3, it's line 340. Okay. You go back to Shakespeare's imagery with animals, you know.
Right.
Was the conversation between Iago and Rodrigo.
Right.
And Iago says, I would drown myself for the love of a guinea hen. I would change my humanity with a baboon.
Yep.
These two references, guinea hen and baboon, do they refer in any way to Desdemona and Othello?
Well, there's a way in which you have to say yes. He's already made some slurs along that line. Only a baboon, he says, right, would, animals behave that way. Human beings don't. Human beings who have reason don't behave that way over love. Okay? But the baboon reference, given what we're talking about, yes. And there are gonna be other animal references that come close to Othello. He's already referred to him as a horse. Okay? He's constantly insulting. But the point is, we get the sense he keeps his wife around because a man needs a woman handy. And that's the way he treats her. It's awful. Absolutely awful. But we also know they've probably been married for a while. One thing I skipped over, very end of Act 1, let's turn to it. Iago's final soliloquy, about four lines into the soliloquy. I hate the Moor, he says, and it is thought abroad that twixt my sheets he has done my office. I know not if it be true, but I, for mere suspicion in that kind, will do as if for surety. Everybody out there is claiming that Othello has cuckolded me, that Othello has been with my wife. There is not one other reference anywhere in the play to this. Nobody says it. Nobody makes the accusation. But curiously, in Act 2, Iago is going to say, and I suspect that Cassio's been with my wife. There's no evidence for it. Nobody else in the play says it. But what we get with Iago is this vision that we're all animals, and hence we all behave the way animals behave, which is anybody with anything at any time. And that's his attitude. And that's his attitude towards his wife. He treats her miserably and then says, and I think Othello has betrayed me with her, and I think Cassio's betrayed me with her. And it seems to be the attitude, well, she's a woman, so, you know, why not? And they're just animals, so why not? He is constantly demeaning everything along that line. So it is very clear we can't believe what he says about Othello there. It's very clear when he says it later about Cassio, we can't believe him. But you see why it's then just a quick jump for him to say, I know what I'll do. I'll tell Othello that Cassio has been with his wife, Desdemona. because everybody's with everybody else. We're all animals. It's a horribly demeaned, depraved, salacious view of love. It's not love. And he says there is no such thing as love. There's only lust. We're all just animals. Yeah. And it's the way he treats his wife as if she's, well, worse than someone would treat a dog. It's horrible. Yeah. Yes, there's a touch of it. There's a touch of it there. Yes. Yes. It's lower than that, though. The point is this. Angelo's view is that all men are corrupt, and what's going on in the streets of the city he's to govern is total corruption. And that's accurate. There is the vision. It's all fallen, and it's become one big cesspool of vice. Okay? Unfortunately, in that play, that's an accurate vision. We don't have the sense here in this play as it opens that Venice is totally corrupt. We do perhaps have a fear it's over-civilized, over-polite, over-refined, so that there's a kind of healthy erotic energy has been drained out of it. Rodrigo's a whiner, you know. We have Rodrigo as the vision of the Venetian gentleman. And no real woman would want to marry him. So that we've got a problem here, but it's not the problem of corruption. I mean, yes, Rodrigo's corrupt, but not in that way. So there's a touch of it, but I'd say the circumstances are different. Shakespeare keeps reusing ideas and themes over and over again. You know, there are just a few basic plots and a few basic ideas. The great artists just keep turning them, you know, looking at them in different ways and forcing new recognitions and new truths out of them. Yeah.
In the play,
does Iago have his career like he does in the greatest? No, he doesn't. And I'll talk about that on Friday. There is no counterpart for that moment in the opera. None in the play. None. That's a creation of the librettist that Verdi turns into a great moment, but it's one of the things that makes the opera completely different from the play. I'll get to that on Friday. Talk about that at length on Friday. We'll look at that moment, in fact. Yeah. Because at that moment, you get an entirely different character. Yes, Father.
From the point of view of Othello and Desdemona themselves, why do you say that this play is about carnal or animal love? Is that love itself presented as merely animal, or?
No, but what you have in terms of those two, I think, is a fear of admitting healthy, genuine, erotic desire. Okay? That clearly, it seems to me, given the picture of the wooing, it's not just intellectual. We have the sense of a man and a woman who are drawn to each other. Okay? And who believe that it is necessary to sanctify that desire before it's acted on. So that in that sense, I call it help. They seek to become one flesh through the sacrament of marriage. And it's very clear they do not in any way act on those feelings until they are married. But in public, they're afraid to even admit they have such desires, or they are yearning for the union of the flesh, because of the way in which everybody seems to view Othello. He's a Moor, he's black, he's just got these passions. We know what those people are like. And therefore they go out of their way to say, no, 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 there's none of that, there's none of it. It's all very elevated and pure, and it's of the mind, and it's of the soul, which it is. I'm not denying that is there. But they cannot admit to the fullness of their love. Curiously, look, we can look at this now. I was going to do it in the morning, but let's take the time and do it now. Almost immediately, and it's the only place in the whole play we get a healthy vision of married love between Othello and Desdemona. And it comes curiously out of Cassio, who seems to be the only balanced character in the play, and he's the one who's then accused. I'm in Act 2, Scene 1, line about 60. It's just after the second, well, let's see. I'm trying to describe it to you. The gentlemen have arrived. Montano comes in. Cassio enters. We have some conversation. And then we find out that Iago has arrived. The ship with Iago and Desdemona has made it safely to Cyprus. Okay? And we hear Cassio says, how now, who is put in? And the second gentleman says, 'tis one Iago, ensign to the general. And Cassio says, he has had most favorable and happy speed. Tempests themselves, high seas and howling winds, the guttered rocks and congregated sands, traitors insteeped to enclog the guiltless keel, as having sense of beauty, do omit their mortal natures, letting go safely by the divine Desdemona. She is so beautiful, she is so innocent, she is so divine, that nature didn't do its usual upheavals, it let the ship go through and it's landed safely, he says. And Montano says, what is she? Who is she? What? There's a woman who's arrived here? Notice again, what? A woman's arrived? We were going to battle. Who? What is she? She I spake of, our great captain's captain, left in the conduct of the bold Iago, whose footing here anticipates our thoughts a senate speed. They're here much sooner than we thought. They're here long before they'd ever get here, but they've arrived. And then we get a little prayer from Cassio, and look at the prayer. Great Jove, Othello guard, and swell his sail with thine own powerful breath, that he may bless this bay with his tall ship, make love's quick pants in Desdemona's arms, give renewed fire to our extincted spirits. Othello hasn't landed yet. Cassio offers up a prayer for Othello. God guard Othello on his journey here. May his ship come safely onto shore, and may he make love in the arms of his wife, and through that healthy marital love, renew all of our spirits. It's a vision of the union of spirit and flesh that is purely healthy within marriage that everyone can rejoice about. It's the only place we hear anything like that. And for the rest of the play, I won't go on, but tomorrow we'll look through the language when Othello finally arrives and is reunited with his wife. And then again, the language of Iago as he talks about the fact, well, the two of them are back together again. Yeah, we know what they're up to. Yeah. On neither side is it healthy. It's fragmented. It's divided. But that speech of Cassio's is essential because it is the full, complete, healthy vision. And it comes in a prayer. And part of the prayer is let our captain get here, let him arrive safely, and then let his be a blessed marriage in the fullness of marriage. And that's healthy, but boy, that's the only moment in the play we get anything like that. Yeah. Yes, we get that. Boy, I like Cassio. I really like Cassio. Fascinating character. Who has his own weakness, we'll find out later in the play. But I don't want to jump too far ahead. But my point is that healthy vision is given to us in the play. It's there. But sadly, the hero is removed from it, the heroine's removed from it, and the villain is certainly not a part of it. But we need that core, yeah.
I come across recently in some of the circuits, some of our young ladies asking us what I thought of them dating blacks also.
Yeah.
And so this play kind of reminds me of that. What did Shakespeare, did he have any point to make when he put this marriage up here? And how did the people receive it then? And how did it, those who study it today, how did they receive it?
Okay, good. Good question. Important question. And I'll tell you, given recent events, I changed my syllabus last fall when I got back to the academy and taught this. I bumped Hamlet last fall and did Othello, and the reason was I knew that they'd all spent the whole summer watching the O.J. trial, and that they're going to watch all fall watching the O.J. trial. And you know, the parallels are scary parallels. They really are. You have a black man who was admired by the nation, who was heroic, who in a moment, in this burst of passion, kills his white wife. It's as simple as that. The difference being, Othello remains heroic. O.J. becomes a worm, proving there was no substance, no character in him at all. But my larger point is this. Shakespeare's audience would have been oddly fascinated by it and found it really peculiar and odd and strange. There weren't Moors walking through the streets of London, okay? So that Burbage would have played the role and put on makeup and would have been, whoa, a black man. But it would have been Burbage. Great actor, he always plays the heroic roles. Shakespeare goes out of his way to make Othello heroic. So we would have had this strange, sort of a strange double pull in, I'm talking about the original audience viewing the play. Ooh, it's a black man, strange, what is that? And they would have pulled back a bit. At the same time, ooh, it's, you know, it's Schwarzenegger. Okay? It's the hero, it's a big heroic guy, this is the heroic actor, so he's gotta be a good guy, right? They would have been very ambiguous, they would have had very mixed feelings. What happens now, of course, is no white actor would dare play Othello now. Have to cast a black actor. And modern critics say, well, it just shows again. Venice was patriarchal, sexist, racist, and the play just shows how awful it was, and thank goodness all that's gone. And now there wouldn't be any problem, and any black man could marry any black woman if they were in love. Well, I'm sorry, recent events show us there's still a problem. Okay? And it seems to me what the modern audience viewing the play is refusing to recognize is, no, you can't just say it's racism and therefore that's, put it down to that. What you have is something unusual happening. It is not usual for a black man to marry a white woman. It's unusual. And therefore there are likely to be problems and tensions. And if there are, let's assume a perfect marriage in which the two love each other deeply. At that point, would one say don't marry? Not necessarily. But what one has to say is recognize the world in which you're getting married. Every time you walk down the street, what's going to happen? Heads are going to turn and people are going to whisper. Fingers will be pointed. You will be called names. Are you ready to have some stupid young punk call your husband thick lips? Are you prepared for that? Because that's going to happen out in the world. And yes, it is a horrible thing, but is your love strong enough to stand up to that sort of thing? So what I'm saying is I think there are social realities that have to be taken into consideration. Now, those are not absolutely necessary. One of the things that amazed me when I was in Brazil is that none of that existed anywhere in the world in which I found myself. You had black Africans, you had brown and red Brazilian Indians, and you had whites, and they had all intermarried for so long that you had every possible shade and combination along the spectrum. And if one person chose to marry another, there was not any kind of approbation with it at all. You saw blacks with whites, browns with whites, reds with blacks, blacks with browns with browns. It was just whooshed. And it was amazing to me, but part of my amazement came from the fact nobody noticed. It occasioned no comment. And it occasioned no comment because you had a society where it had all been taken care of long ago, and so it didn't matter. We do not live in that kind of world. Therefore, I guess what I would say is, love is love, and that is very important, but a married couple has to be aware of social realities. And I have a very dear friend who married a black woman. And their concern was what will happen to the children. You know, the children can be brutally cruel to each other. And their concern was will our children be mocked? Will our children have problems? They went ahead anyway, and it seems to be a very happy marriage. It seems to be working.
Move to a traditional marriage down in Brazil, Argentina.
That's the best answer. That may not be a practical answer. What I would say is, be very aware of the nature of the love. And if it develops, is the love strong enough to withstand the social problems that you'll probably encounter? That's a very difficult call, I think. I think that's a very difficult call. Because, well, Shakespeare knows, it's part of what he's working on. Like tends to like. And if you have something that is outside of that norm, you're going to have problems. And is the love strong enough to withstand the problems? And immediately they all say, yes, of course. Of course, what the play makes clear is your love strong enough to withstand an Iago? Okay? Or in the OJ trial, is your love strong enough to withstand the total corruption of the modern American life with money, with lots of money and sex and drugs? And the answer again was, whoa, no. Not even close.
It seems to me it's a slightly different situation because here we have Othello, who is a real hero. In other words, he is the highest of what we would expect even in Venice.
Venice needs him.
So his true character is, we could say, Venetian. He doesn't look Venetian, and so they assume he's not, which is why he will not even ask permission to marry the daughter. Now in our country, we assume everyone is the same, when in fact there is, an unwillingness for true integration. There is no submission to the culture at large.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a bizarre opposite twist of what we see in Othello.
Although let me say this, what Othello is a Venetian, he has come into the state, he has become a Christian, but the real horror in this play is what happens to him in Acts 3 and 4. Because Shakespeare understood civility is something we assume and take on and try to live. And the instant it goes, you're back to what you were before. And we don't accept difference. We refuse to acknowledge that there might be a difference in kind. We were, for good and ill. For good and ill. We pretend it's all the same. The play is I think the play is making very clear it's not all the same. Oh, I can't wait for you to see the Olivier performance. Oh, man. Oh. But we've gotta wait. Yes.
What I find most interesting about Shakespeare are his departing words, which are inscribed on his tomb.
Yes.
Would you like to comment?
Oh, yeah. Those of you that don't know, there's a curse on Shakespeare's tomb. We don't know who wrote it. We guess he wrote it himself. Good friend, for Jesus' sake forbear to dig the dust enclosed here. Blessed be the man who spares these stones. But cursed be he who moves my bones. That's the inscription on the tomb. People have been very puzzled as to why that's there. I have my own theory. The standard theory is it's because at the time because the plague kept going through, they were running out of grave space. And it was common to open up graves and put new bodies in. And that therefore he didn't want that, and therefore he put the curse on it. My theory is, and I connect it with that letter I mentioned earlier, Master Shakespeare died a papist. I think he received last rites and requested the family to bury him with a rosary. maybe a scapular. And he was afraid that word would get out in this Anglican community that he had died a Catholic, and somebody might try to open the grave to see if there was any sign of that religion there in the grave. And hence, he put a curse on the tomb. He didn't want anyone in there because his family, his daughter had married a very prominent Anglican doctor in the town. And it could have caused a real stir. So I think he received last rites in private, and I think he was probably buried with some sign of the Catholic faith, but he didn't want it to become a future problem for his daughter. He was not a courageous man. We know that. He never came forward and took a big stand on any of the major issues of his time. He was not a courageous man. He was a truth teller in his works. But personally, he was apparently rather quiet. Gentle Shakespeare, he was called by those who knew him. He apparently was a very gentle, quiet man and didn't go out of his way to stir things up. Yes.
Question, besides Hamlet, and you can elaborate on Hamlet too if you want, who
is
he most like of his characters?
I think there are three. This is my personal theory. In fact, one of the real interesting things about Shakespeare is he tends not to be in his plays. Most writers, you pick up a novel of Hemingway and you open to any page and it just screams, "Hemingway, here I am!" Okay? And that's true of most writers. You pick up a page of Ben Jonson and it's all the characters are somehow, you know, it's Jonson manipulating them. You pick up Othello and what we get is Othello and Iago and Desdemona. We get the characters. We don't feel Shakespeare here, okay? He removes himself. With three exceptions, I think. One is Hamlet. Hamlet, I think, is a very personal play. And he wrote it as he was descending into what I call the furnace of doubt. And boy, it's all over the place. The other is the very last play he wrote, The Tempest, and it's Prospero, who's the magician artist who's controlling everything and is leaving the island where he's performed his magic and retiring to where he came from. It's Shakespeare's last play. He's leaving London. He's saying goodbye to the theater, and his voice all the way through that play in the character of Prospero. The other one is something I'm convinced of, and I can't prove it, but I'm just sure of it. It's Bottom the Weaver in A Midsummer Night's Dream. If you don't know Midsummer Night's Dream, Bottom is the low comic character who's a braggart and a fool, and they're putting on a little play before the Duke, and he says he can play all the parts, and he has no imagination, and then suddenly they're out in the woods, and Puck puts an ass's head on him, and all of his friends desert him, and he's alone in the woods wearing this ass's head that he can't see, but other people can see. And it's been done to punish the fairy queen, who falls in love with the first thing she sees when she opens her eyes. And she sees this ass. And she falls in love with the ass. Bottom is walking around with the ass's head, braying and hee-hawing.
Hee-haw, hee-haw.
And his braying awakes the fairy queen, who wakes up and looks at this ass and says, "What angel wakes me from my flowery bed?" And it's what Bottom, of course, looks around. "What angel? Angel?" And she falls in love with him. And suddenly the queen of the fairies is in love with him. He has no idea what's going on. Okay? And meanwhile, her husband is making fun of her, and all the fairies are laughing at her and using Bottom. But in the whole play, the audience sees the fairies, they're on the stage, the woods are filled with these fairy creatures, but nobody in the play sees them. Nobody. Except Bottom, the lowest, dumbest guy in the play. And he's granted a vision of them. And suddenly, the head is removed, she wakes up and, "Ah, what was I in love with? Ah!" And her husband says, "See, I taught you a lesson." And he says, "I've had a most rare dream. I've had a vision past the power of man to say what vision it is. You know, and sort of, me thought I was and me thought I had." And he said, "I saw this out here." He says, "I will have Peter Quince write a ballad of my dream, and it shall be called Bottom's Dream because it hath no bottom." And he says, "And then I'll sing it. I'll sing it at the wedding of Duke Theseus." Okay? So we go to the wedding, they do their little play, which is just awful, awful. They mean it to be serious, it's the funniest thing, it's a play within the play, it's the funniest thing ever done. And the nobles are all sitting there laughing at them, because they're all such fools. And at the end, Bottom comes up to the Duke, comes up to Theseus and says, now I have a little song I want to sing, and we'll do a little dance for you. And he says, no, forget it, really, you've done enough. But what he's about to sing is the ballad of what happened in the woods. And all the other characters are debating what went on in the woods, what was out there. He's about to tell them, he knows. But who could believe a yokel, a nobody, with little education, could suddenly see things that nobody else sees? I think that character is a reflection of something the man himself thought. He had an eighth grade education. He comes from Stratford. He's an actor in the theater. He tries to write a play, and suddenly he's writing Richard II. Suddenly he's writing Romeo and Juliet. It had to have scared him. It had to. He's suddenly seeing things nobody else is seeing. He's putting down things nobody else is putting down. Who? Will Shakespeare? Little Will Shakespeare? What am I writing? How did that... For me, Bottom is the vision of a common guy who suddenly, for an instant, is granted the vision of a genius. And I think Bottom also gives expression to something that happened to Shakespeare. I think he was stunned by it and couldn't believe it happened to him and tried to tell people. Those are the only three. Those are the only three I'd give you. All the others, I think, are created characters. Created characters. He was an observer, he had an incredible imagination, and his plays are rarely personal. He's commenting on the world around him as he saw it, and particularly those truths of human nature that are unchanging. Types of human beings that we bump into, they were there from the beginning and they'll be there as long as human beings populate the earth. You know? And the amazing thing, it's all in here. It's true. It's all there. It's incredible. No other writer has come close to the range of created life. Who is it? I forget. Someone said, after God, Shakespeare hath created most. And in one sense, Dante didn't create most of his characters. He knew them. He just puts them places. He didn't create them. Shakespeare created all these people. It's amazing. Thousands of created people, and they live. They're alive. You know, we know Hamlet better than we know some real people. They're more real to us. You know? It's amazing what he did. Anything else? Oh, that's enough. That's enough. We'll go. Keep reading Othello. We'll go on with it tomorrow.